Hi, and welcome to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court, the law, and the rule of law. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I cover those things for Slate. And to quote our jurisprudence editor, Jeremy Stahl, and Slate Plus members, you're going to hear from him in today's bonus episode. Yikesy yikes, said Jeremy. That was his reaction to this week's tsunami of legal news. Yikesy yikes, FYI, is like a 9 on the jurisprudence editor Richter scale that we use here at Slate. So it's been a week and not in a good way. On Monday, the court heard arguments in a homelessness case that seeks to address how far cities can go in terms of criminalizing people for sleeping outside, an oral argument in which Justice Sonia Sotomayor was moved to ask, quote, where are they supposed to sleep? Quote, are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping? End quote. Oh, but it got so much worse. On Wednesday, the court heard arguments in that ER stabilizing abortion care case, the one known as Moyle versus United States. We covered it that day in our bonus episode, and the arguments had justices pondering whether just mere trivial permanent kidney damage is something doctors should factor in when they're deciding what kind of stabilizing emergency care to provide to pregnant patients. We had some quality musing in that argument over whether pre-viability fetal personhood could trump actual living, breathing, parenting children, working a job, driving a car, adult woman personhood. And yes, for at least some justices, the tie goes to the not viable fetus. Oh, but that was just Wednesday. We staggered on to Thursday, the moment the nation has been waiting for, when the Supreme Court was finally going to stir itself to hear arguments in Trump v. United States, the immunity case so sweeping that it has drawn outright guffaws from the somber bow-tied ranks of former Republican Party stalwarts and Republican jurists. But not so from the MAGA justices. As we are about to discuss, the proposition that criming while in office is not beyond the reach of the law appeared to persuade only really the trio of liberal justices. But 4, 5, maybe even a cool 6 of the court's conservative justices looked ready to adopt some version of the position that while coups are regrettable, coup fomenting, fake elector fabricating, find me those extra votes, shakedown phone calling, DOJ firing presidents are not prosecutable, or not this one who's running for president again right now. But we don't mention his name because we are writing for the ages. Where even to begin? But begin we shall, and with the very best of guests. Pamela Carlin is the Kenneth and Harl Montgomery Professor of Public Interest Law at Stanford Law School, co-director of Stanford's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, and has twice served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, most recently as the Principal Deputy Assistant AG from 2021 to 2022. She is the co-author of leading casebooks on con law, constitutional litigation, and law of democracy. Pam, it has been just forever since we've had you on the show. I know that your tour in the Justice Department intervened with your ability to opine freely, but welcome back, dear God. We missed you and we need you today over all days.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Mark Joseph Stern is Slate's senior legal writer. And Mark and I were listening together on Thursday and also on Wednesday. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you. I had the misfortune of actually being in the courtroom on Thursday, listening and watching. And that did not enhance the experience in any way, shape, or form. I would much rather have been in my PJs gossiping with you over Slack. But alas, I was trapped in that evil chamber watching democracy die before my
eyes. I mean, it's just a showing that they shouldn't have arguments on Thursdays.
That is what it proves. All Thursday arguments are bad. I think we could wrap here. It seems that So I want to ask actually a framing question, which is just, this was an incredibly narrow interlocutory appeal. This was meant to be, right? The case has not gone to trial. The way this is supposed to go, there was a pretty narrow question before the court. Is that right, Pam?
Yeah, and the court itself wrote that narrow question. That is, that's not the question, you know, usually the parties write the question that the court is going to grant certiorari on and decide. And here the court wrote its own question and wrote a question that I thought going into the argument was so narrow that the answer was obvious, which is, does the president have immunity for acts that are within his official duties? And the indictment here has a number of acts that have nothing to do with being president in it, the things about fake electors and the like. And so I thought, you know, going into this, they had written a narrow question so they could write a narrow answer that said, yes, this trial could proceed. And instead we had, you know, as you said in the introduction, Justice Gorsuch musing about how they should be writing for the ages. Although, honestly, you have to wonder whether we'll have ages if this is the kind of treatment we have for presidents who break the law.
And just in that vein, Mark, I guess one of the things that was arresting to me listening to arguments is that initially, sort of for the first, I almost want to say, third of John Sauer, that's Donald Trump's attorney, at least a third of his presentation, because the question was so narrow and his admissions were so vast, right? He's like, sure, a president could, you know, order an assassination and that could be sometimes within his official duties. Sure, he could order a coup and that too, depending on the context. So it seemed as though this was an insane recitation of, you know, if this is the narrow scope of the case and he's essentially admitting to everything he said at the DC circuit argument, which was crazy then, it felt as though, and so I want to say, like, for the first third of his argument time, I was like, oh, they should have just, this should be a summary affirmance, right? Because he's doing the same thing he did. This is crazy. And the question is limited to this. And then things just took a turn. It turned into a whole other discussion.
Yeah, it totally went off the rails. And I think you're right. It felt like a replay of the D.C. circuit, right? You had the liberal justices like Sotomayor and Kagan asking these now famous questions. Could the president order the military to assassinate his political rival? Trump's attorney, Sauer, had to basically say yes. Could the president order the military to stage a coup?
He was the president. He is the commander-in-chief. He talks to his generals all the time, and he told the generals, I don't feel like leaving office. I want to stage a coup. Is that immune?
If it's an official act, there needs to be impeachment and conviction beforehand because the framers viewed the that kind of
if
very
it's an
low
official
risk.
Act, is it an official act?
If it's an official act, it's impeachment.
Is it an official act?
On the way you've described that hypothetical, it could well be. I just don't know. You'd have to, again, it's a fact-specific, context-specific determination.
That answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act, but that sure sounds bad, doesn't it?
And it felt like at some point the conservative justices leapt in and decided this was going too poorly for Team Trump. And so they had to expand out the scope of the case from what, as Pam pointed out, was a narrow question that they themselves crafted to suddenly bounce all over the map. A clear statement rule for criminal statutes applying to the president, jury instructions, immunity versus a defense, official acts and conduct versus private conduct. And at one point, Justice Kavanaugh stepped in and he literally said,
I'm not focused on the here and now of this case. I'm very concerned about the future.
Excuse me, Brett? You're not focused on the here and now of the case before you that you have to decide as a justice, a major case that the nation is watching? And that felt like such a tell for me because it was like the conservative justices knew that Sauer was presenting a losing hand. And so they had to step in and try to rework this to not only benefit Team Trump now, but to create this broader immunity for presidents with a R next to their name, I think, to crime all they want and not face any kind of criminal consequences. That was a shocking revelation and admission to me. And I think it really points toward the broader problem with these extremely messy and unfocused arguments.
Can I just jump in and say that, you know, you were saying a third of the way through things seemed to be going well and then they went off the rails. I actually think it was actually later than that that things went off the rails, because towards the end of Sauer's argument, Justice Amy Coney Barrett came in and said, you know, everybody had kind of agreed, and I think there isn't any disagreement, that a president who engages in private acts that are a crime while he's in office can be prosecuted afterwards, even though the OLC takes, the Office of Legal Counsel takes the position he can't be prosecuted while he's president because it would be too disruptive. So if, you know, Donald Trump claims on his tax returns a bunch of deductions for children who aren't his, he can be prosecuted for tax evasion later on. And it doesn't matter that he signed his tax return in the White House or he ran off the forms on the White House printer or the like, because that would be a pure private act. So Justice Barrett went through the indictment.
You concede that private acts don't get immunity.
We do.
Okay. So in the special counsel's brief on pages 46 and 47, he urges us, even if we assume that there's, even if we were to decide or assume that there was some sort of immunity for official acts, that there were sufficient private acts in the indictment for the trial to go, for the case to go back and the trial to begin immediately. And I want to know if you agree or disagree about the characterization of these acts as private. Petitioner turned to a private attorney, was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenges to the election results. Private?
As alleged. I mean, we dispute the allegation, but
of
that
course.
Sounds private to me.
Sounds private. Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge.
That private. Also sounds private.
Three private actors, two attorneys, including those mentioned above, and a political consultant helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding, and petitioner and a co-conspirator attorney directed that effort.
You read it quickly. I believe that's private. I don't want to...
So those acts you would not dispute. Those were private, and you wouldn't raise a claim that they were official.
Then he kind of said yes, and I thought at that moment, okay, what this case is going to be is an easy, quick remand to say, given that at oral argument, the former guy's lawyers conceded that some of the acts that are alleged as the overt acts, if you will, in the conspiracy are private acts, this case can go forward. And then they had the sort of where Mark was going, then they had the conservative justices saying, pay no attention to the case before you. I am the Wizard of Oz. And that's kind of where the rest of the argument went while Michael Dreeben was up. That is, if the argument had ended after after Sauer's opening argument, I would have said, I think this case was going quite well. And you could tell just how much they leapt in to help by the fact that when it came time for Sauer's rebuttal, he said, no, no further things. You know, you've done my work for me.
Rebuttal, Mr. Sauer?
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
We should explain to listeners, like, that never happens, right? One of the great benefits of going first to the Supreme Court is you get these 5 minutes of rebuttal where you get to pick apart what the opposing counsel said. And Sauer, it was remarkable to watch, and some of the justices actually did look surprised. He just waltzed up, swaggered up to the lectern and said nothing further. Because, as you said, Pam, the men on the court had already done his job better than he possibly could, and he was wise enough to keep his mouth shut.
And it was really interesting, I would say, that it was Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson time and time and time again who kept trying to bring it back to, no, this is the question before us. This has already been admitted. Let's go home. It's Thursday. We're not meant to be here.
Even if we decide here something, a rule that's not the rule that you prefer, that is somehow separating out private from official acts and saying that that should apply here, there's sufficient allegations in the indictment, in the government's view, that fall into the private acts bucket that the case should be allowed to proceed.
Correct.
Because in an ordinary case, it wouldn't be stopped just because some of the acts are allegedly immunized, even if people agree that some are immunized. If there are other acts that aren't, the case would go forward.
And I felt as though she was saying this thing so many times in so many ways that, you know, you all are needlessly freighting this up with a bunch of garbage. At some point, I believe it was she that said, this is an interlocutory appeal that's been freighted up with a whole bunch of other junk. But there was just a sense that they'd be like, they're there, and threw another bag of junk onto the train. I mean, it was such a strange dynamic because you really could sort of in plain sight see her saying, like, I thought we were here to do this one thing, and nobody wants to do this one thing. And under this one thing, he loses, he lost at the jump. And so it was this very weird move. And I guess, you know, we can go through, if you want to, these questions that Mark laid out. Suddenly it turns into criminal statutes have to say this applies to the president, that there is this private official act disjunction that we're fighting about. All of these pieces of it honestly had nothing to do with the case at hand until suddenly that was what we were talking about for 2 hours.
It was kind of disconcerting to see what seemed to be a relatively straightforward question, which is trying to steal the election, is trying to undermine an election a crime that anyone in the United States who commits it can be held liable for, to, well, what should we do about this? Because if we decide that Donald Trump can be prosecuted, then can't we go back and retroactively pull Franklin Roosevelt out of the grave and do something about Korematsu? I mean, Operation Mongoose, for God's sakes.
Mongoose,
which probably nobody remembers because it was in the Kennedy administration. They didn't ever stop to ask themselves, why is it that no president has ever been prosecuted in the past? And the answer is because no president in United States history has ever tried to stay in office after he was defeated. Gerald Ford left office. Jimmy Carter left office. George H.W. Bush left office. Herbert Hoover left office. What is with Donald Trump that he won't leave office? And we kind of know the reason he doesn't want to leave office is because when he's out of office, he's vulnerable to being prosecuted.
Right. Because, and his own attorneys during that second impeachment trial, right, go before Congress and say, listen, you know, you don't need to impeach and remove Trump for January 6th because he's subject to criminal prosecution later. The criminal justice system can take care of this. Mitch McConnell, Republican senators, one by one say, we're not voting to remove Trump. We're voting to acquit because we think that the criminal justice system can take care of this. And then twist of all twists, we discover that, in fact, the criminal justice system has nothing to do with a former president who tried to steal the election. And I think the conservatives sort of spun out different theories of how they can make that into law, right? And Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch had this idea that they were going to make up a new clear statement rule, a kind of pop-up clear statement rule that no federal criminal law applies to the president unless it explicitly says, you know, is stamped with the words, this law applies to the president. And as Justice Sotomayor points out, like, there are only a tiny, tiny handful of criminal statutes that specifically say they apply to the president, because before Thursday, nobody had ever seriously thought that this was a thing. And this was certainly not in the question presented, right? This was just the boys spinning off in their own world.
And they keep toggling back and forth, which is they agree that the president can be tried for acts that are not official acts, which means all of those statutes that say no tax fraud, no drug dealing. I mean, you kind of wonder what these justices would say if Donald Trump had been peddling ivermectin to people out of the back of the White House without a prescription, right? You'd think there's federal drug laws. Of course he can be prosecuted. And they seem to be suggesting, well, if he does it in the White House, then you need a clear statement rule that says no president shall deal illegal drugs. And that just can't be right.
We are going to pause now to hear from some of our great sponsors. More now with Professor Pamela Karlan of Stanford Law School and Mark Joseph Stern. So I actually want to ask, there was this theme that Justice Alito trotted out that was kind of bone-chilling.
I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully if that candidate is the incumbent.
Of course.
All right. Now, if an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election – knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?
For me, this was when I went through the looking glass. Like, this was that democracy requires giving immunity to criming presidents, because otherwise they won't leave office. And I think Mark and I said in our piece, it literally felt like some articulation of, like, don't make me hit you again, democracy. And so, Pam, I just would love for you to react to that statement, because for me, the very notion that stability requires allowing broad immunity so that presidents who commit crime will agree to retire peacefully is so insane.
Yeah, that was the moment where I felt like saying, that's what just happened. Right? This is not, this might happen in the future. It's, that's what's already happened. And if you let people get away with that, what you've said to Donald Trump is, if you win the 2024 election, do not bother to leave office in 2029. Just stay there. I mean, that's really what the Supreme Court is saying, is there's not going to be any crime if you try to stay there. And I did have this, it wasn't just through the looking glass. It was, did you just hear what came out of your mouth?
I think this was a great example of Alito being fully, like, Fox News brain poisoned during these arguments. I mean, I think this has been happening for some years. He used to ask these famously great questions, you know, could the government ban books, turning Citizens United on its face, and like, really getting to the heart of whatever progressives are trying to argue that doesn't quite cohere. But over the last few years, it's just been culture war grievances and stuff that falls apart upon even a little bit of scrutiny. I think he's losing his edge. And that was clear not only in this bizarro question, saying that actually constitutional democracy requires us to let presidents off the hook when they engage in a criminal conspiracy to steal elections, but it was also his next round of questions to Michael Dreeben, who was representing Jack Smith, right, where he had Dreeben walk through the layers that sort of protect a president from a frivolous or a vindictive prosecution, and then dismissed each one out of hand, right? So Dreeben said, look, at first, you have to have a prosecutor who's willing to bring charges, and that prosecutor is, of course, accountable to the president, who's accountable to the people. A grand jury has to indict. You know, there has to be a criminal proceeding in court. Eventually, a jury of his peers have to decide whether he's been found guilty. And Alito just laughs it off.
There's the old saw about indicting a ham sandwich.
Yes, but I think Justice Alito,
you had a lot of experience in the Justice Department. You come across a lot of cases where the U.S. attorney or another federal prosecutor really wanted to indict a case and the grand jury refused to do so.
There are such cases.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
Yes. But I think that the other
every
level
once
of,
in a while, there's an eclipse, too.
Well, I think that that's for the most reason is prosecutors have no incentive to bring a case to a grand jury and secure an indictment when they don't have evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's self-defeating.
As though all of that is one big joke. Like, oh, prosecutors will do anything they want. We all know Justice Department line attorneys are hacks, right? Nobody believes a grand jury is doing anything worthwhile. And then, oh yeah, a jury of his peers. Like, that's going to do anything. And this is all coming out of the mouth of the justice who is by far the most friendly to prosecutors and most hostile to criminal defendants in case after case after case, right? The guy who could not for the life of him find a right to a jury trial in the Sixth Amendment or like due process for criminal defendants. But when that defendant is President Trump, or former President Trump, he suddenly thinks that this entire system of criminal prosecution is so feeble, such a bad joke, that the Supreme Court itself has to step in and essentially quash this prosecution, as I read his arguments, because we just can't trust the system to work. The system that is incarcerating so many other people who Sam Alito is just rubber stamping their convictions right here. No, 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 no. We don't believe at all in that system. them. It's such a laugh. We can all laugh about it in open court being a bunch of BS and understand that it requires the adults in the room to do the real work of letting Trump off the hook.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Pam, because I really felt like that was a turn for me where it was like winkingly, you know, we both worked in the Justice Department. We know what a racket that crap is. And again, it was a moment where I felt the thing you expressed, you know, about that other statement about, you know, oh, we have to let presidents commit crimes because stability. This was another one of those. I'm sorry, did one of the justices of the United States Supreme Court just overtly say that everything that happens at the Justice Department is hackery and, you know, rigged prosecutions? Because if he did, I would like him to write that sentence. It was shocking.
Yeah, I mean, there was that shock to it. But notice what's underneath all of that is, you know, we're worried about vindictive prosecutions. And we haven't seen any up until this point. That is, no president, you know, prosecuted the president who came after him. The closest we come is Gerald Ford giving a pardon to Richard Nixon. And for all of what Sam Alito was saying to be true, he has to believe that this prosecution itself is a vindictive prosecution, which means he has to have bought Donald Trump's narrative. And then he's attacking the deep state, which is the career line prosecutors. And when he does this with Michael Dreeben, I mean, the thing to remember about Michael Dreeben is almost his entire career, Michael Dreeben's career, has been as a nonpartisan civil servant who's gotten up there and argued cases on behalf of the Bush administration, argued cases on behalf of the Trump administration, argued cases on behalf of the Obama administration. I mean, what Justice Alito did is essentially say, I'm living in MAGA world, in which this is a totally bogus prosecution, ginned up by totally bogus people as part of a vindictive prosecution by Joe Biden. And he's also implicitly saying, and if Donald Trump gets reelected, you just know he's going to prosecute people vindictively, too. I mean, he really has lost faith in the entire system, or at least is prepared to lose faith in the system enough to decide this case in Donald Trump's favor.
I wanted to ask both of you about originalism, in part because, you know, Mark and I are obsessing about it for our end of term big kind of package on what the whole term meant. And in part because there was this amazing moment. I think I just want to play the audio from Elena Kagan.
The framers did not put an immunity clause into the Constitution. They knew how to. There were immunity clauses in some state constitutions. They knew how to give legislative immunity. They didn't provide immunity to the president. And, you know, not so surprising, they were reacting against a monarch who claimed to be above the law. Wasn't the whole point that the president was not a monarch and the president was not supposed to be above the law?
I had to turn back to Dobbs here, because at the outset of Dobbs, right, Justice Alito says thunderously, the Constitution makes no mention of abortion, as though, you know, that's it. Case closed, shut the book, doesn't use the word no right. You know what else the Constitution doesn't mention? The words presidential immunity. And as Kagan points out, right, they knew how to put it in. There is legislative immunity, but not presidential immunity. And I guess this felt like one of those mask off moments from the court's originalists, because you had, especially, I think, Justice Kavanaugh railing about these policy concerns about what happens if you have special counsels and independent counsels, these policy concerns about what it means to criminally prosecute a president. But he is just reading those policy concerns into what he calls Article 2. He can't cite any real provision. You have Justice Jackson going through, citing all of these duties, saying, okay, well, these are clearly official acts. Can we draw the line here? Kavanaugh doesn't do that. He just seems to think that Article 2 makes the president a king, and that's the end of the story.
Pam, I guess I want to ask, this case exists on two axes. One is the legal merits, as you suggested. The other is a temporal axis, which is this had to happen quickly. There was, I think, some slim read of hope that the court could have written narrowly and disposed of this rapidly, and this case could begin in Judge Tanya Chutkan's courtroom in Washington, D.C. it appeared, at least I was getting big remand energy from enough justices that I think it's going back for something. I don't even know what the something could be. I wonder if you feel like speculating wildly both about what a remand could look like and then the sort of, I think, on the temporal axis question, whether this is game over because we don't have a trial before November.
I mean, there are a couple of different things that could happen on remand, right? The best version of remand would be, and I think, you know, Justice Sotomayor suggested this, is you send it back down and you say, there are a bunch of acts that the president's lawyer conceded were private acts in a conspiracy. That goes to trial, but you have to give a cautionary instruction with regard to the one thing that's pretty clearly, I think, an official act, which is his use of the Justice Department, right? Because only the president can misuse the Justice Department. An average Joe can't. Whereas all of the other things that Donald Trump is alleged to have done, including pressing Mike Pence, are things that any candidate could have done. So you send it back and you say, you know, you have to have a trial that narrows what's going on to liability can only come from the private acts that he did. But what worries me is they send it back down for more proceedings of some kind on which acts are official, which acts aren't, having decided that he's immune from prosecution for the official acts, which then gives him another potential round of appeals because immunity of this kind is being treated as something that you can have an interlocutory appeal on. And I should explain probably for the couple of listeners who might not know this, that generally if you have an argument that you can't be prosecuted for something or that the prosecution can't use particular kinds of evidence or the like, you have to go to trial. If you're acquitted, great. If you're convicted, you then appeal everything at once at the end of the case. And that's a little bit what they were getting into when they started talking about, well, could a president have a defense of saying, yes, I did this, but you can't hold me liable because of the, you know, public function doctrine or whatever. But I think what they've done is they've created a system where there could be another round of appeals to the Supreme Court before there's a trial. And as probably most of your listeners know, they all flee Washington at the beginning of July. And so the idea that a court that's already dragged this out, they could have taken this case in December and we could have been back down in the district court in January. And instead, we're looking at May or June for this. Words fail me sometimes when I think about this, how little the Supreme Court actually cares about protecting our democracy at this point.
I totally agree. I just want to add one footnote, which is that I think it's really disappointing and alarming that the court could cut out of this case Trump's efforts to actually use his presidential authority to steal the election, because that really is the power of the charges against him, of the narrative here, that he abused his office, used those powers to unlawfully interfere in the peaceful transfer of power to another president in violation of many laws and in violation of the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, right? Which,
well, in violation of the presidential oath, which requires him to take care that the laws be executed. And that means taking care that we have an election and a peaceful transfer of power and that he packs up his stuff and heads back to Mar-a-Lago.
And so to slice that out of this case, to either not present it, and I'm not sure how that would work, I don't think anyone is, but to not present it or to tell the jury to essentially disregard it when it's considering liability really weakens Smith's argument for criminal liability and also weakens the impact of this case, I think, for the American public, because it transforms from a case about a corrupt president abusing executive authority in order to maintain an unlawful hold in office to a ratty, nasty guy who happens to be president, engaging in all of this conduct, you know, the fake electors, the lying, whatever, the fraud, in order to maintain his hold on office. But you can't think about that latter part. All you can look at is the kind of, frankly, small ball stuff that to me, had always been in the background of this broader theme of abusing executive power, official power, official duties, whatever the Supreme Court's going to call it. And so I do think it's going to be really unfortunate if the court reaches that quote-unquote compromise. And I think that seemed to be where Barrett was going. I mean, Barrett by far asked the best questions of the conservatives. She actually seemed to be trying to do law, unlike the guys on the bench. But she seemed to think that what you need is some kind of hearing before the case goes to trial, where you separate out the official acts from the private acts and only allow the private acts to go forward, or develop some kind of way for the jury to only consider the private acts. Now, I think there's a silver lining that could actually turn in to a kind of mini trial in Judge Chutkan's courtroom. Like, I think that could be very salutary and positive and give us a kind of glimpse of what will happen and maybe release more evidence that the public deserves to see. But it would ultimately mean that if and when the jury convicts, it convicts on the basis of this small ball stuff that to me does not even begin to tell the whole story of the criminal corruption and conspiracy.
Can I just drop a footnote to your footnote, which I agree with everything you said, but did it not strike any of the justices that if Joe Biden, as the challenger, had done what Donald Trump had done, he could be put in jail, but Donald Trump, as the president, does exactly the same things and he can't be put in jail? I mean, that just strikes me as so lunatic that, you know, if Joe Biden had done false affidavits or had pressured people or the like, he could be put in jail. And if he had won the election, he could be tried for all that stuff after he leaves office. And somehow this idea that because you're president, you get a get out of jail free card forever just is mind-boggling.
Let's take a short break. You are listening to Amicus with me, Dahlia Lithwick. Let's get back to my conversation with Professor Pam Karlan and Mark Joseph Stern about the gobsmacking oral arguments at the High Court this past week. So, Pam, I think this takes me to the place I wanted to sort of wind up on this conversation, and we can turn to EMTALA in a second. But I think you're both saying, and I'm certainly feeling it myself, this is not the John Roberts court that I expected to show up at this argument. And I think you're both saying that as sort of blinkered institutionalists like myself, I'm getting an immense amount of I told you so blowback. This, like, I told you there are a bunch of partisan hacks. I think I would love to hear from each of you why this was just so shocking, because it's not just that it was shocking on the merits. And it's not just, as we've kind of dick through the arguments, that a whole bunch of ancillary crap was sort of chummed into the case. It's that, at least for me, I truly believed at least seven members of the John Roberts Court took the potential failure of democracy as a proposition seriously enough that the partisan kind of valence of this case went away. And I think you just said it, Pam. That didn't happen.
So part of what's shocking about this is juxtaposing this against Trump against Anderson, which was the case earlier in the term that involved whether Colorado could keep Donald Trump off the primary ballot for having engaged in insurrection, which under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, disqualifies you from holding an additional office if, after you take an oath to support the Constitution, you engage in an insurrection or rebellion. And I think coming out of that argument, where the court fairly swiftly reached a unanimous bottom line that they were going to keep him on the ballot because that's what democracy requires, to let the people decide, you kind of thought, well, maybe they have some kind of grand bargain here, which is you'll keep Trump on the ballot, but you'll say, of course, he's not immune from prosecution for engaging in crimes that undermine the very democracy that you just said you're so committed to protecting. And instead, what we got was nothing about protecting democracy. And to go back to something Mark said earlier, not letting the people decide, which is the way the people decide about crimes, is you take them to a jury and the jury decides whether somebody's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's like, democracy for me, but not for thee, is kind of where the Supreme Court seems to be ending up. I mean, maybe they'll surprise us and it'll be they were just letting off some steam. But where the argument seemed to go was all of the things that they said in Trump against Anderson had no, played no role, had no weight in how they're going to decide Trump against United States.
Right. Anderson was, screw originalism, democracy demands more. And then this was, screw democracy because some other thing, because we don't want overzealous prosecutors to go after presidents. Mark, do you have a thought on the question I just posed to Pam, which is, I think you and I have spent 2 years saying the John Roberts Court is conservative, yes, but nihilist, no. And I think maybe we were wrong. And the one sort of coda to the question, if questions can have codas, is I think the mere presence of Clarence Thomas on the bench makes a point that you and I have been struggling with, which is the rot is so deep that we expected too much.
Yeah. I mean, at one point there was a discussion of Trump and his allies pressuring state legislators in swing states to nullify the results of the election and award these fake electors to Trump, right? And I thought, oh, you know who else pressured state legislators to do that? Ginny Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, who is sitting right here before my eyes, fully participating in this case. I mean, that corruption now feels so baked in that I think we just sort of move along. But in a sense, I feel like it delegitimizes this case and proves that there are at least a few members of the court who just believe that January 6th was no big deal. Clarence Thomas undoubtedly thinks January 6th was no big deal. The broader minimization of January 6th, the refusal of the conservative justices to seriously engage with what happened on that day, to kind of brush it off with these breezy questions about, oh, we don't really care about this case. You know, we're deciding a rule for the ages, as Justice Gorsuch said. That was remarkable to me. It was a little less shocking only because last week in arguments in the Fisher case, right, we similarly heard the conservatives minimizing January 6th. That was a case about these obstruction charges that had been brought against 350 some odd January 6th rioters, also two of the four charges against Donald Trump in the January 6th indictment, right? And there too, we heard the conservatives, again, just laughing off what occurred on that day. And it's no surprise too that in Anderson, they were willing to sort of just shrug off January 6th, barely engage with what many have, I think, accurately described as an insurrection, and say, of course Trump can appear on the ballot. What is this nonsense? So yes, the nihilism got to me. It felt deeply corrosive. It felt like a real affront to the democratic system that these guys purport to be safeguarding. I completely agree with Pam's point that jury trials are a fundamental part of our democracy. I mean, Justice Scalia, before he started to kind of lose it in the end, would write quite eloquently about this, that, you know, this ability to insist on being tried by a jury of your peers is fundamental to the idea of representative government, was fundamental to the framers. And it all seemed to wash away with, I think, an assumption on the right that, of course, a jury in D.C. would, you know, indict a ham sandwich and convict Trump because he's a Republican. I found all of that incredibly dispiriting. Essentially, what I think we saw was a conviction on the right flank of the court that every aspect of democracy that the rest of us are subject to, including a criminal justice system and a right of trial by jury, that all of that can't really be trusted to work on its own when it comes to Donald Trump, and that Trump has some kind of constitutional guarantee for these guys to leap in and give him an assist and give him what Pam called a get out of jail free card. I think that's exactly right. One that we all recognize would never be granted to a Democratic president. Whatever rule the court comes up with, they might as well insert a Bush v. Gore style disclaimer that this is a ticket good for one case only. For all their talk about deciding a rule for the ages, not focusing on the here and now, this was ultimately all about crafting a rule to try to prevent Donald Trump from facing accountability.
It's true. In a strange way, Mark, you've really captured it. Donald Trump was both everywhere and nowhere in that hearing, right? And the events of January 6th were everywhere and nowhere. I want to just turn to Emtala for a brief second. Mark and I did a pop-up show about it and we wrote about it. But I'd love to hear from you, Pam, and I think we've covered it enough on the show that folks know this was the case about Idaho, which has a much more constricted notion of what ER doctors can provide in terms of care, and it conflicts with EMTALA, which is the federal statute that lays out what stabilizing care is that hospitals are required to provide. And I think the question, Pam, can be just be one of atmospherics, because, again, it felt as though there was very little serious reckoning in the courtroom with what actually happens to actual women who show up with ruptures, with hemorrhaging, with sepsis, with the potential of organ damage. And it seemed like it was quite a lengthy meditation on arcana about separation of powers or the spending clause. I guess my question for you is, it was fascinating to me that when tasked with explaining why Idaho prosecutors were going to go easy on physicians who stand to spend 2 to 5 years in jail and lose licensure if they guess wrong about the daylight between EMTALA and the state trigger law, the answer was prosecutorial discretion. It was that prosecutors are going to take care of these doctors because prosecutors are good people.
That struck me as one of the things that was so different about the two cases. One of them is, you know, doctors shouldn't worry about being prosecuted when they do their best within the scope of their official duties, but the president really does have to worry, right? The other thing that seemed like a contradiction to me, and this again goes back to something Mark was saying, is that both cases seem to be girls against boys on the court as well. That is, you know, we all know that Justice Barrett is a very strong pro-life, anti-abortion force on the court, but she at least understood what was going on here. And the male justices just didn't seem to think there were any women in this case. I mean, there was that moment where Justice Alito says, well, we've been talking a lot about the women, but now let's look at the statute. What about the unborn child? And the fact that the words unborn child are in the statute shows that there's no point in protecting emergency treatment for women that terminates a pregnancy that hasn't yet ended. Even though, as Elizabeth Preligar, who did a phenomenal job at the argument, and by the way, was Miss Idaho, you know.
Wow, fun fact.
Did you not know that? Yeah.
I knew she was from Idaho. I'm not sure I knew she was Miss Idaho. Wow.
And so, you know, she understands Idaho, and she was up there doing a great job in the case of pointing out just what's happening on the ground. And it was like, yeah, that's happening on the ground. But what about here at 35,000 feet? Let's talk about how you actually bring a spending clause case.
Right. And just to make a kind of wonky point that I think is a through line, Idaho did not raise that spending clause argument in the lower courts properly, right? So Idaho forfeited that question, as several liberal justices pointed out. And yet the conservatives, especially Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, tried to raise it from the grave and use it to override the interests of women in Idaho who are, we know, being airlifted from hospitals in Idaho to neighboring states because they need emergency abortions that are still criminalized in Idaho because EMTALA is not in force on the ground there and the state only allows abortions when the patient is on the brink of death.
Well, and if you read the news, in addition to all of the examples of women being airlifted out, we may end up with no doctors in Idaho at all because doctors are leaving Idaho because they can't, you know, OBGYNs are leaving because they can't practice. Emergency medical folks are leaving Idaho because they can't practice. And, you know, the Supreme Court that's so concerned about the future in the Trump case seems utterly unconcerned with the future welfare of people in Idaho, already born people in Idaho.
And I guess I just want to make the point that if these cases come out and the majority tries to spin them as these narrow, technical, complex decisions, if EMTALA comes out on spending clause grounds, which would be outrageous because it was a forfeited argument, but whatever, you know, if the Trump case comes out with this really sort of Byzantine distinction between official and private acts with this complex remand that's going to take months to sort out, we're going to get a lot of gaslighting from the right, from the court, from conservative media and politicians saying, how, you know, you silly folks who are outraged about this, you just don't understand the law. It's so complicated. Why are you talking about women's lives when you should be talking about the spending clause? Why are you talking about January 6th when you should be talking about, you know, Article 2 and all of these granular details of Article 2 that the court is making up on the spot and then applying to President Trump and nobody else? I would just urge everyone not to fall for it. The gaslighting is going to be bad, but should be overcome by the knowledge that every listener of this show will have, that I hope the majority of the American public will have, that the court did this to create a smokescreen to obscure the injustices that it is inflicting. That the court will take these cases and wrap them up in arcane doctrine, sometimes doctrine involving questions that were forfeited, in part so that the public reaction is muted and so that the public might feel it doesn't fully understand the impact or import of the case. Do not believe it. It will not be so. They did that and they knew what they were doing. And we all have every right to be outraged about what's actually going on in these decisions, which is the ongoing minimization of January 6th, the ongoing dismissal of women's health and women's lives, the elevation of hypothetical interests of a fetus over the actual woman who we had thought deserved equal treatment under the law. All of that should be front of mind, and whatever arcane garbage they come up with to disguise it, just set that to the side.
I think that what you're saying, Mark, what you're saying, Pam, is that for those of us who spent the interregnum between January 6th, which happened, by the way, across the street from the Supreme Court, let's not forget, and this past Thursday, waiting to see a performance of the justices as the grown-ups in the room, instead saw a performance of I don't know what all, but if that is being a grown-up, I want to stay a kid forever, because that was just ponderous chin-stroking and a whole bunch of like squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. And in the face of, as you said, Pam, some of the most exigent, important questions that the court has ever faced in American history. And that was not a performance of taking it seriously. That was a simulacrum of what taking it seriously would be.
I mean, women are facing grave health crises. Democracy is facing a grave health crisis. And the Supreme Court just doesn't seem to care.
The Supreme Court doesn't seem to care. I think that was the original title of the draft of the piece that Mark and I wrote on Thursday. Pamela Karlan is the Kenneth and Harl Montgomery Professor of Public Interest Law at Stanford Law School and co-director of Stanford's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, and has twice served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, most recently as the Principal Deputy Assistant AG from 2021 to 2022. She has written multiple leading casebooks on constitutional law, and there is nobody whose voice we have missed more on this show. Pam, thank you so much for being here. And Mark Joseph Stern is my trusty co-pilot on this nightmare we call covering the Supreme Court. Mark, it is always a treat to have you around. Thank you.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's like, you know, what's that line that Lyndon Johnson said when he first addressed the nation after he became president? All I have, I would gladly give not to be here today. I mean, I sort of feel that way talking about these two cases.
And Slate Plus members, I will see you in the Amicus Plus subscribers-only bonus episode. This week, Jeremy Stahl reports from the Manhattan criminal hush money trial of Donald Trump. He is sitting in the room. If you are not a Slate Plus member, you can listen to that episode now by joining our ever-growing merry band of Slate Plus subscribers. Not only will you unlock exclusive bonus episodes of Amicus, but you will also access ad-free listening across all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts by clicking Try Free at the top of our show page, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. And that is a wrap for this episode of Amicus, the full-on nihilism edition. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so very much for your letters and your questions and your comments. You can keep in touch at amicus@slate.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. And hey, did you get your tickets yet for our Washington, D.C. live show on May 14th? That show is going to be really crucial for understanding the end of this Supreme Court term and to understand so very much of the court's radical, revanchist jurisprudence of the last several years and an understanding of what we might be able to do about it. So go to slate.com/amicuslive to snag your tickets and to get more details. And we will pop a link in the show notes and we will see you there. Sara Birmingham is Amicus's senior producer with help from Patrick Fort. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio at Slate. Susan Matthews is Slate's executive editor. And Ben Richmond is our senior director of operations. We will be back with another episode of Amicus next week. Until then, hang on in there.